Welcome to Award Winners. I'm your host, John, joined by our co-host, the great David, muckraking film reviewer and Mel Gibson's least biggest fan. This is our night at the Oscars, where we watch Oscar-winning movies while enjoying Oscar Mayer Wieners. It's a celebration of American culinary and cinematic pop culture. In this episode, we talk about the courtroom drama and biopic, The Life of Emile Zola, winner of the 1937 Oscar for Outstanding Production. Dave, what's going on?
Not much. I'm glad we got this going. It was a pain in the ass.
Pain in my ass. That was our test phrase today because we could not get this thing working right. We had a dead computer. We're just going to roll with it.
See what happens. If there's any glitches, blame the goblins.
I blame the French.
The French. Always blame the French military. That's a good segue.
So that's what our movie's about. It's a French military drama. Do you want to dive right into that? Or do you want to talk about anything else?
Well, let's do our regular stuff, all right? So,
our regular banter. What movies have you seen recently?
I saw Dr. Sleep.
And?
I loved it. I think it's fantastic. Everyone should rush out and see it. I don't usually say that. But it bombed at the theaters, so it probably won't be there very long. It's this season's Blade Runner. You know how Blade Runner, a couple years ago, just got rave reviews, but no one went and saw it? Same thing's happening to this movie.
Gotcha. I quite loved Blade Runner 2049.
Well, you have good taste, John.
Thanks, Dave.
I mean, that's why we have this podcast, so we can share our taste with the world.
Yes, our homogenous taste with everybody else.
Hey, sometimes we disagree, okay?
That's true. So, Dr. Sleep, give us a quick recap, Dave. It's a Stephen King sequel. What's the first movie in the series?
It's a sequel to The Shining, based off the Stephen King book, Dr. Sleep. It follows Danny Torrance, the little kid from The Shining, essentially as he battles psychic vampires. The best part of that film is the villain, who is this flower child sort of woman.
Sounds like a hippie.
Yeah, it's like a super hippie villain who would tell you, don't vaccinate your kids and then murder you. It's really good and weird, and I highly recommend it and check it out.
Some people say not vaccinating your kids is murder.
Yeah, I'd be one of those people. I also have one more thing to talk about before we jump
whoa,
in.
Whoa. Okay. Let's talk about Dr. Sleep for one more second here. Why do you think it bombed? I'm going to give you this guess and you can tell me if you think it's accurate. My guess is that people didn't know that it was the sequel to a movie that they really liked because Dr. Sleep does not say The Shining 2 in any part of its title.
I mean, that's true, but all the ads show the Overlook.
That you mean that's the hotel, correct?
Yeah. All the ads basically are like, this movie is connected to the Overlook. You should see it. And the poster is Danny Torrance is shoving his face through the door like Jack Nicholson did in The Shining. I get that, but I think it's kind of weak. I think the real reason is it's a movie that came out, 35, 40 years after the original? And it's competing with a movie that's considered one of the great pieces of cinema canon. I think people saw it as a cash grab other than what it was, which is a good film.
Thanksgiving is coming up this week, actually, and that is a pretty big movie weekend. So maybe it'll pick up some steam and people just aren't seeing movies because they're busy prior to the holiday.
That's a good guess. Let's hope.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. So you had something else you wanted to talk about, Dave.
I guest hosted Movie Films and Flicks. That's another podcast that we are associated with. We covered Son-in-Law, the Pauly Shore movie about Thanksgiving.
I want to give you a Pauly Shore-ism, something like, oh, it's the weasel or something. I don't remember enough to give you a good one. So that's all I've got.
Well, here's the thing. By the time this episode comes out, you can go check that episode out because it drops on Thanksgiving. This is the first time I've sat down and watched this movie with a critical eye. I have watched it every year on Thanksgiving for the last 3 years. It is a problematic movie. I'm honestly surprised that I didn't catch all the stuff happening in it. You never watch something, it's like popcorn, you don't think about it. You're just like, okay, funny. But when you sit down to think about it, I was just like, wow, I don't know if I could watch this movie again.
I'm sorry, Dave. How many years did it take for you to discover this?
Three.
Okay. So if you were Pauly Shore in a Pauly Shore movie, what phrase would you use to describe this movie?
This movie? This would be some acceptable filmage.
Okay. There we go. That's good. How about That's you? Good. I can't remember this movie for the life of me. So the one I'm thinking of is In the Army.
Yeah. That's his like third or fourth one.
With his camel toe joke. All right. That's all I've got. Okay. So Dave, let's talk about The Life of Emile Zola. How would you describe this movie?
It's the life of a French intellectual as he intervenes in one of the most critical moments in France's history.
And what is that moment?
The Dreyfus Affair.
What is the Dreyfus Affair?
Oh, you're pulling it out of me. The French military framed a person for trading secrets to Germany, and the intellectuals came out against it and said, you know, you're railroading this dude, and it caused a lot of strife within the government because people were doubting the government, people were doubting the military, and it divided the nation.
Just as a quick recap, it's essentially the story of a French journalist exposing the military's framing of an innocent officer. Let's dive into our red carpet, or maybe not dive into the red carpet. Let's sashay across the red carpet. So if you are a first-time listener, you should know that we eat movie-themed hot dogs while watching these movies. David, how's your hot dog dressed on the red carpet this evening?
So I had a really difficult time coming up with a hot dog recipe for this film because they don't eat a lot of food in it. There's like some cognac. I think they talk about lobsters at one point, and that's it. There's nothing else. So I went to the tried and true method of looking up different variations of hot dogs on Wikipedia, and I came up with the French hot dog, which might I add is actually Danish, but it's called a French hot dog. So what you do is you take a baguette, you hollow it out, you shove a hot dog in there, and you cover it with, it's called French hot dog sauce or French hot dog dressing. And I looked it up, and it's basically like a combination of mayo and mustard. The sauce sounds great. It actually sounds really, really good. I haven't tried it because I don't have a baguette at the moment.
The sauce sounds like it's a take on any secret sauce. I think McDonald's Big Mac secret sauce or special sauce, whatever it's called, is just Thousand Island dressing and mayo and ketchup or something like that.
All secret sauces have like the same five ingredients.
Actually, that does sound nice. It just sounds like a creamier mustard.
Yeah.
Have you ever made like honey mustard? Those are two ingredients on your way to honey mustard. Add the honey in there and you've got honey mustard.
Yeah, I think it's great. I almost did pigs in a blanket because it's a croissant, but I thought that was cheating. So I went with an actual recipe.
And I entirely forgot about making a hot dog for this. So just like the Dreyfus Affair, it escaped our collective memories.
Okay.
Yeah, I totally forgot.
It's all right. Well, you can have half of mine. We can meet in the middle.
That would be, is that a French movie?
If there was three of us eating it, it would be a menage a trois, I guess.
Speaking of food items, do you have any food facts for us?
Yeah, I have a very small fact. So again, there's not a lot of food related to this film, but Emile Zola is somewhat known for his food writing. He wrote The Belly of Paris. It's a novel that centers around a very large marketplace. From all my readings, it's supposedly some of the best food writing ever put down in any language. And it's very famous. When I searched up food writing, it was in the top 10 of everything I read. And a lot of it has to do with the main character describing the pleasures of walking through this large market and going through a cheese shop. I know you want to know what it's called, so I'm going to try to do this. I do not speak French. So it's the Les Halles.
I'm looking this up right now just to
I don't think it exists anymore, but it was a big deal when he wrote about it.
You know, Dave, I think I was there. I have been to this place.
Oh, awesome.
It's a kind of a mall. Yeah, I was definitely there. I didn't really spend much time in the mall because why would you? It's the Monoprix. They had American hot dogs there, which had diced tomatoes on top of them. They called them American dogs, like New York style. And I was like, that is definitely not New York style anything.
No, no. New Yorkers would take that and throw that at the shop owner.
That's right.
We're mean. Since we touched on cheese a little bit, John, what's your favorite cheese?
Fromage.
Fromage? Explain.
That's how you say cheese in French.
Okay.
Fromage.
But what's your favorite brand, your type, your taste? What is it?
I don't really have favorites of anything, I have to say. But right now, I'm enjoying a red Leicester called Red Fox. More than one brand put out a cheese that's like this. Essentially, it's like a sharper cheddar. And inside of it, when it's cured or whatever you want to say, cultured, I'm not really sure what the name is for processing cheese. It forms these calcium crystals in it. So it has a little bit of a crunch to it. I kind of like that texture. with the cheese. Imagine Cinnaburst gum with flavor crystals. Does that make
sense? It does.
Sense?
It makes 100% sense, and it sounds awesome.
It's got a little bit of a crunch to it. It's not cinnamony. It's just a little bit of crunch, so it gives it a nice little texture in the cheddar.
Mm-mm.
What about you, Dave? Do you have a favorite fromage?
It's whatever cheese is in my refrigerator at 3 a.m. when I'm drunk. Other than that...
Velveeta?
Yeah, I just a big spoonful of Velveeta right from the center of the block, too.
You're one of those people. You're like, I'm just going to go right into the middle. We're not cutting off an end.
I think my favorite type of cheese is smoked Gouda.
Okay, yeah. That sounds pretty Gouda.
Yeah, followed by a sharp cheddar. I'm sure there's other cheeses I really love, but those are the two I go back to constantly.
Here's a weird cheese fact that was in the newspaper the other day. Do you know what country the best cheese in the world is from?
America.
It is. Do you know where? Do you know what it is?
I don't know what it is. I read an article saying that some place won, but I don't know where it's from.
I think it's a type of blue cheese from California, I believe.
Oh, California. They have it all.
Ironically, I went to like a little dinner party thing the other day. The people we were with, they had read the article too. And that specific cheese was on sale at Whole Foods. Money off of the original price. So those fools didn't know what they were getting rid of.
Oh, those, they might have known.
The best cheese in the world is on sale.
But you can't have like a lot of blue cheese. You just like try a little bit of it.
Yeah, I agree. It's all right. It really wasn't my thing, but it was all right. Have you ever had one of those cheeses that are like dipped in champagne and it has like a little extra taste on it?
Yeah.
This is one of those cheeses.
Okay. A little too much for me.
Gotcha. I don't think it's for everyone, honestly.
But what do we know? We're not cheesemongers.
It beat all the French cheeses in terms of the best cheese in the world for the year.
Yeah, but they'll probably say it was rigged.
That's fake news, Dave.
Fake news. Fake cheese, fake news.
All right. Let's get into some factual things. Speaking of fake news, movie facts. You want to run us through this?
Absolutely. So this film came out August 11th, 1937. It has a runtime of 116 minutes. Its budget was $700,000.
I want to put a little asterisk next to that. I am not sure that is true. I was trying to find the budget information. This is what I saw in another article. I could not find anything to confirm this. And same with the box office gross. I couldn't find that. It doesn't seem to exist. I'm not sure they do exist.
Okay. So this was directed by who, John?
This man. Why don't you pronounce his name for us, Dave?
William... Dieterelli?
It's a German name. Whatever you said. That sounds
Dieterelli.
Right.
He was actually nominated for Best Director for this film, but he did not win. He left Germany in the early 1930s because it was becoming increasingly unstable. He came to Hollywood to produce German versions of movies. He did such a good job that he built a career on it, and he eventually got his U.S. citizenship.
It's an American success story, if you will.
So this movie went up against a bunch of movies that you probably have never heard of, and I'm going to list them off.
I'm like, should we even bother? Just read the one that everyone would know.
I mean, it's kind of true. I've looked up every one of these movies. I was like, I don't know what these are except the very last one. Just out of a sense of completion, we're going to do this, and I'm going to do it quickly. It went up against The Awful Truth, Captain's Courageous, Dead End, The Good Earth, In Old Chicago, Lost Horizon, 100 Men and a Girl, Stage Door, and A Star Is Born. John, which one of those did you know?
I don't know, but a porn parody name, 100 Men and a Girl, is so good.
It's not even a porn parody name. It probably is.
I know nothing about these. I think that's the original A Star Is Born, right?
It is. It's the original Star Is Born. That's the only one I knew about this. I looked them up as well, just to read a little synopsis on everyone to see if like maybe I just didn't know the name. I know nothing about them, and they all look boring. So there you go.
All right.
So I should note, though, I think this is important. 1937 is the year that Snow White by Disney was put out.
Okay.
That was also the top grossing movie of the year by a shit ton. I was looking up the converted box office and it was like Snow White and then like nothing else, really. Some other movies that came out that year, just, you know, throw things out there. There was Wee Willie Winkie, and that is with Shirley Temple. I know I've seen that movie as a little kid, but I couldn't really tell you the plot. The name just has always stood out with me. And then Broadway Melody 1938 also came out this year. And one of the things I should note here is that Snow White, it was nominated for only one award, and that was Best Score. I can't remember if it won, but the next year it was given an honorary Oscar. So essentially it was like, oh, we screwed up. We probably should have given Snow White Best Picture Oscar. So the next year we're going to reward it with something else again.
Let's talk about that later. Yeah, after we go through this.
All right, let's move into movie trivia. Guess what, John?
What?
There's not a ton of trivia. I searched high and low for trivia about this movie. I got very little.
Okay, take us through it, Dave.
This movie was nominated for 10 Oscars. It won 3. It won Outstanding Production, Supporting Actor, and Best Writing, Screenplay. Studio boss Jack L. Warner ordered that the word Jew, and that's in quotes, be removed from all dialogue in the movie in order not to offend the Nazi regime and hurt potential business in Germany. So that came from a source that is somewhat questionable when I was reading about it. It's called The Collaboration Hollywood's Pact with Adolf Hitler. It seems that some people disagree with this study, but I'm just going to throw it out there so you can look it up and decide for yourself.
Miss Miniver, that was one of the movies that they were revising it as the news was happening, and they decided to, in fact, just make the Nazis the enemies in that film. So we saw this happen in other points
of
history.
It wouldn't surprise me. It's happening now. The remake of Red Dawn. It wasn't Russians or North Koreans. But they, movie studios do this all the time. They adjust things to make it better for a larger market. Especially with very big movies. If you're a smaller movie, you probably get away with it more.
I understand the commercial reasons for this, but they decided to take that stand eventually. They probably should have taken it sooner and maybe regret that.
Here's probably the most interesting thing I found about this film. It was shot in reverse order. And that's so actor Paul Muni, he had a real beard. As the film moved to younger periods in Emile Zola's life, they just dyed it dark and cut it closer to his face.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's a good way to do it. It was pretty cool. You want to do some actor facts, John?
Yeah, so I try to dig these things up. I basically had the same experience you did when looking up movie trivia facts. Not a whole lot about these actors. So Paul Muni, he was nominated for Best Actor for this role of Emile Zola. He was actually the original Scarface in the 1932 movie. He was known for playing historical roles, so he played Louis Pasteur, Voltaire, Alexander Hamilton, and thoroughly researched the characters before playing them. So you could say it was a pretty accurate representation of the person. He was widely recognized as an eccentric, if not talented, actor. He objected to anyone wearing red in his presence, which is freaking crazy, and could often be found playing the violin between filming sessions. So he had 4 Oscar nominations for acting in his lifetime. One is actually considered unofficial, which I think is a kind of interesting story. So that is for the movie The Valiant. And the reason for this is at the 2nd Academy Awards, no acting nominees were announced, only the winner. Later, the Academy went back and said, although there weren't official nominations, they did record who was considered by the judges. So he got a retroactive nomination. I think the only other actor of note in this movie is Joseph Schildkraut, and he won Best Supporting Actor for his role as Alfred Dreyfus. Although he was nominated for Best Actor for this role, he did not plan to attend the Oscar ceremony because his agent mistakenly informed him that he was not a favorite and was not going to win. He'd actually gone to bed. Someone woke him up and said, "You need to get your butt down to the Oscar ceremony," where he got his award. He showed up just in time.
You think he was like in his bathrobe?
He's probably just like, oh, God.
Speech, all right. speech.
Speech. He's just like, "I'd like to thank my wife for answering the phone. Not my agent. Fuck that guy." Finally, he was Otto Frank in the 1959 movie adaptation of The Diary of Anne Frank. I think that's probably what he's best known for. If you watched that movie when you were in grade school, he's probably the guy you saw.
I don't remember that movie at all.
I don't really either.
All right.
It's been since grade school. 2 other things just to tie us into why I think this movie was important. So this is what was going on in 1937. Things were deteriorating in Nazi Germany at the time. And this movie, which is basically criticizing a government for failing its people or accusing people of things they didn't do or blaming people for things they didn't do, especially Jews, because this Dreyfus affair that we're getting into was actually a very anti-Semitic thing, they were bringing attention to this again. So they wanted to let people know that governments aren't always honest and sometimes are smearing honorable people or individuals for their own ends. Dave, now that we've covered everything we could find about this movie, are you ready to dive into it?
Oui.
Great. Let's discuss this movie. It's set in France We're in Paris. We meet 20-year-old Emile Zola, played by Paul Mooney. He's a struggling writer living in poverty with his roommate, Paul Cézanne. Do you know who Cézanne is, Dave?
I know the name.
Not yet, but he will be a famed Impressionist painter. Mm. So they're buddies, kind of part of that art renaissance of France at the time. Congratulations, guys. They're in Paris to try to make their way in the world. Zola's fiancée, Alexandrine, tells him that she's procured a job for him as a clerk at a bookshop. And he's very excited to have that because he's very much a struggling writer. So the movie skips at this point ahead several years, and we keep seeing that, and that happens pretty rapidly. And if you're kind of not paying attention, you wouldn't notice this. So we skip ahead a little bit. Zola's now married and struggling financially. He's written some provocative novels. This one in particular is called Confessions of Cloud. He's getting threats from the government. They're saying, you know, you can't keep writing this stuff. You're criticizing us. We don't appreciate it. Knock it off, or things will happen to you, bad things. They also threaten his employer, saying, you're employing this jerk. Zola quits, basically. He gets severance, and then he goes and writes his books.
So what do you think about the employer here? Was he in a rock and a hard place?
I bet at the time he definitely was, because the government could really assert that kind of control over someone. So he probably does have a right to be worried. These days, we would say, like, that's crazy. It seemed, especially in this movie, that the government kind of did whatever it felt like and flaunted the rules all the time.
So what's sort of a modern take on this? Like, if someone has a YouTube channel that the owner doesn't like, they just fire the person?
I think the modern take is Middle Finger Lady. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Here in D.C., there was a lady who was riding her bike down the street. President Trump's motorcade went by, and she gave him the finger. A picture of this was snapped and shared to social media. She didn't take that picture. She didn't even share it. Someone found out who she was. She actually worked for the government. She was fired. I think they eventually found that it was a wrongful termination, and now she actually ran for a government position locally and won.
It's a really interesting position. I have a lot of mixed feelings about it, because I understand as a business, you should be able to get rid of people that you think might harm the overall institution. But part of me is also like, that's bullshit. If it doesn't affect their work, who cares?
I feel like there's a balance with that, too. It depends on, like, what they're doing. So are they inciting violence? Are they extremists? Here, you're right. This is kind of tough because he is kind of doing some of those things to some degree.
Yeah. Well, I guess the book is what we would call, quote unquote, pornographic, like less than tasteful. It's a tough spot. I think you're right that it depends on what is happening and how it affects the company and organization. And if the government was definitely involved, that's real bad.
I don't think the government should influence people in that way unless you've got really solid reasons, and I feel like this isn't one of those reasons necessarily.
Did I ever tell you about the time that I was on Fox News and got chewed out, and then the organization told everyone to call my company and harass us?
No, I don't think I've heard this story.
Yeah, so I worked for a company. We did these listicles that were somewhat provocative, and I got tapped to be on Fox News for a piece that was called The Most Redneck Cities in America. Note that I did not write this. I did not approve writing it, and I fought against it and failed. But I had to go on Fox News to defend this thing. I was on for maybe 3 minutes, got chewed out, and then the guy I was interviewing with instructed all his listeners to call my company and harass us, and that went on for like a day and a half.
I mean, what was the end result of all of that?
The article got pulled, and new guidelines were put in place for what we could write. But I just want to be very clear. Again, I did not approve of it. I said it was a bad idea, but because of the position I was in, I was sort of the person who had to go shovel shit.
What were the criteria for Most Redneck City in America?
I couldn't even tell you anymore, because I'd have to look it up. But it basically, I was like, guys, I think this is really derogatory and we shouldn't do this. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure it was like low education was one of them.
Oh, OK. So, I see how you're digging yourself into that hole already.
Yeah, and I was like, this is such a bad idea. I really don't want to do this. And then, like, I remember my boss published it with my name on it, and I came in. I was like, I didn't write this. What the fuck are you doing? And I put his name on it. I was like, no, this is you. This is your shit. You own this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real bad time.
The only place my mind goes is to a 1990s video game called Redneck Rampage.
Oh, God, yeah.
Do you remember this
game? I do, yeah.
Every time you yeehawed, you got 1 point of health back.
We live in such a different time.
Yeah. Yep.
That was like fueled by Mountain Dew and Cheetos and sexism and racism.
It was a lousy first-person shooter to begin with. You know, they're just pumping stuff out at that time. Yeah. Okay. So Zola starts selling articles and essays. He's publishing them. He's found a house that will publish them for him. That's how he's making his revenue. He's publishing books.
Books and articles. He's like doing anything he can.
You know, he's traveling from city to city and writing about what he sees. He's interviewing people. He's actually done quite a little bit. We learned that lots of people are living in poverty in France at this time. Working conditions are terrible and that the police are cracking down on less desirables. And I'm saying that in quotes. During these police raids one night, you know, Zola's having a drink with Cezanne at a bar and a prostitute runs in because the police are cracking down on this group of prostitutes outside. They're just arresting them. He tells her to sit down with him and they pretend that they were all together from the very start. The police say, all right, you're going to get away with it this time. We kind of know what you're doing, but we're not going to do anything about it. We're going to keep our eyes on you. And they leave. In this process, this prostitute, he starts talking to her about her life and then writes her story. It turns into a book called Nana. So, Dave, you want to add these notes about?
I read a little bit about this book. It turns out that the story shown in the movie is slightly tweaked. The novel was actually inspired by the exploits of Anna Judick. And she was a polyamorous comedic actress. And that's sort of where the story came from. It was also turned into several different films. Most recently, it was turned into a BBC miniseries that came out in 1968. There's also a 1934 version. And I also think that this is a very good point to talk about Zola's work. He wrote a 20-something book story. Nana is one of those stories. It's like the third or fourth book in the series.
The series is what? A series of biographies about different people around France?
So it follows two families in France, an upper class and a lower class, through a specific period of time in French history. I believe it's the Second Republic. I might be wrong with that. But that's his whole work, was like all his books were related to these two families and follow these two families.
So none of this comes through in the movie.
Yeah, I had to look it all up because they were just like, he made a book and then there was a montage scene of just like books falling off a counter, just showing how fast he was writing.
The book isn't a proper book. I wouldn't say pornographic exactly, but people, they read it secretly. So Zola, he goes into the publishing house. He goes to them and says, hey, can I have an advance? I'm really broke. My wife wants food. Pretty sure this book is going to sell pretty well. The publisher says back to him, come into my office. Let's chat. We find out that the book has actually done very well. So in that first week, even though the book is not considered proper, it sold more than 15,000 copies. The publisher's like, this is a huge hit. Here's some money. You're going to be rolling in the dough soon. This was amazing.
This is one of my favorite scenes, actually, because at the beginning of it, there's this woman. She's with, I guess, her husband, and they're walking out. And she's like, should I read this? The husband is like, no. But then she leans into the bookseller and goes, have it sent to my house.
and then what happens?
Well, I don't remember what happens.
So she leaves and he buys a copy and sticks it in his coat.
Oh, I must have missed that part.
Yes. So like everyone's pretending not to have read it, but everyone has read it. I have this question for you. Do you have any modern comparisons for this? I think I have one in mind. So it's like something that a lot of people read, but isn't really considered like good, in quotes, literature.
Twilight.
I was thinking like 50 Shades of Grey. It's like things, people read these things. They're kind of embarrassed to admit to it, but they sold millions of copies. I think Kindles were selling better because people wanted to not have the book cover with them. So they would read it on their Kindle instead of the actual physical copy.
Is there any book you've ever read that you've been embarrassed about?
I've read more Goosebumps books than I should have as a kid.
As an adult?
I don't think so because I give up on things really quickly. Like if I don't think it's good, I'm not going to continue reading it. I think the one thing I tried to read and could not do was Hunger Games. It was awful. The writing is so bad, I had to quit.
I read a romance novel as part of one of my book clubs. And I was sort of embarrassed to read it and talk about it because there were some very explicit sex scenes in the novel. Now I can't remember the name of it, but I had so many eye rolls. This sort of reminds me of this prank that this guy does on the subway here. He like prints out really weird covers, the books, just holds it up. He's not even reading it. One of them was How to Eat Ass. And it would just be a pic.
I've seen this. I've seen that, guys. Yeah. It's not one of those, like, dino human lover stories, is it, Dave?
No, no. You mean by... Those are by Chuck Tingle, the greatest author the last generation has ever produced.
Did you know there's, like, a D&D adventure, Chuck Tingle? They call it the Tingleverse?
Yeah.
Like, you can like, buy, like, a role-playing whatever version of his books.
His stuff is erotica, but it's also satirical, and it's fantastic. Like, look at the covers of his stuff. Like, he had one that came out the other day. What was it?
I saw the horny ghost of
Osama
bin Laden.
Yeah, they're ridiculous. Yeah, I would look him up if you guys have a chance.
Actually, on my Kindle, I haven't really read it, but I have KFC released a romance novel of the Colonel.
Oh, I have it too.
Romancing. Do you remember what it was called?
No, I don't, because you sent it to me and I was like, yes, I'm going to get this free romance novel.
Yeah, like spicy chicken sandwich or something. I don't remember what it's called, but I want to finish that. It's low on my list. Every time I start, I'm like,
I don't want to get too turned on.
Yeah. This is spicy.
I know this is a long bit, but here's a real question I have for you. Why are these books that are considered improper mostly to do about sex?
It was just taboo to talk about.
Maybe. And even in America, like, books about sex usually get relegated to, you know, improper status.
I guess.
Culturally, we're Puritans.
But also, so, like, if we're looking at it from the hoity-toity academic standard, am I a better person for having read a romance novel? Did I gain something? I don't know. I haven't really read any romance novels, so you guys can tell me I'm totally wrong and you bang people better because you've read them. I don't know.
Well, it's not just about banging. It's about learning your sexual desires and wants and being able to act on them and having comfortable acting on them by having positive role models, I guess.
You guessed? I feel like you tossed that "you guess" in there to kind of like say, I don't do that, but I do, I guess.
Because, well, I was getting at, like, not all of them have positive role models is what I was saying, but like, okay, having positive representations of the things you like out there is good. It's like, I recently watched Secretary, right?
Yeah, I've seen that.
And that is a positive representation of, not BDSM.
Well, it's like a dominant and subservient relationship, which is part of
and
that.
And like that is typically played for laughs on TV. But there is a section of society that's very serious too.
I think you and I have talked about this in other capacities. I'm going to paraphrase. You said, don't let other people downplay your yums.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
don't
that.
Let other people harsh your yums.
Yeah. So it's the same with any of these things. I think Elton John said this, right? He said, there are 31 flavors of, comparing it to Baskin and Robbins. Why only ever eat vanilla?
Yeah. But that in itself is also kind of a dig. Some people really like vanilla.
He's just saying, like, you can try other things too. Like, there are other things. Like, you can really like vanilla, but have you ever tried anything else? You might like it. You never know. I think it's kind of what he's getting at.
Yeah. That I get it.
This is what I say. If you like it and you're not hurting someone else and everything's consensual, you know, fuck yourself silly.
Excellent. We've had a very interesting conversation with this part.
Yes. And this has absolutely nothing to do with this non-sexy movie at all.
It's very unsexy. You're right.
I'm cutting all of this.
No, keep it.
Pulling us back to Zola, an old unsexy man. So this book, huge success. There's a scene where he goes back to the prostitute. So he's learned her story. She's basically lost a child. She has this, like, tragic story. She can't even go home because I guess she's the less desirable.
Yeah.
But what he does is, since he made so much money, he goes back to her place, leaves a copy of the book saying, thank you so much. This has really helped me. Here's a copy. And then also some cash from the proceeds. So I thought that was kind of nice. I don't know if that's real.
Yeah, I don't know if that's real either, but it is nice. Do you know, when I was reading about him, he had an affair that resulted in two kids.
The Dreyfus affair?
No, the Zola affair, which was an affair, real affair.
Yeah. Okay.
And this reminds me of a story of that, is that the woman he was having an affair with had a kid and gave it up for adoption. And then he and her went around trying to find the kid, and they found out that it eventually died before they found it.
Jeez.
Yeah, that's really sad. So I guess I'm assuming that might relate to this story a little bit. I'm not entirely sure.
I don't know. I want to bring us back to this because what we're going to see in a second is that none of this fucking matters. We spend 30-40 minutes on early Emile Zola, and it turns out that's really not even the point of the film. This is all expose to show that he is a guy who's not scared to go up against the government. And boy, do I think we could have covered all of this faster than 30 minutes.
Yeah, you could probably didn't need that starving artist bit.
Or we could have like really filled a lot of that in pretty quickly, I think. So we skip ahead again. He's written several books, some of them criticizing the army. Again, people tell him to knock it off, but he continues to crank the books out. He is seen as like a hero of the people. They're appreciative of him. We finally get to the point where he's old and he's kind of ready to retire, right? He's no longer a struggling artist. His friend Cézanne comes to visit him. He's showing Cézanne his giant collection of rich person things. Cézanne says, you know, Paris isn't for me anymore. You are not the person I once knew. I'm probably not going to come visit you anymore. They've grown apart and they have different wants and desires at this point in their lives. He's no longer that hungry, starving author who's fighting the big fight. He's not even that person anymore because he's living in luxury so far removed from his simple origins. He can't even write accurately about that. I would compare this to
Kanye West.
The joke is, or like Jay-Z. It's like, so what do you rap about now that you have $1 billion? Like how your luxury car doesn't work right? Your private jet didn't come in on time? Like, what do you possibly rap about? What struggles do you really have?
I found the real reason that him and Cézanne had a falling out is that Zola wrote a book that had Cézanne in it, and it talked about the bohemian lifestyle, and Cézanne wasn't happy about it.
Does Cézanne look bad in it or something?
It wasn't quite clear, but it was implied.
Okay.
Because I can't imagine writing a book about my friend and then being like, sorry, dude.
You're actually, I don't really like you. Cool. I feel like there are a lot of little things in this movie. If you don't know the history on it, they kind of touch on these little things, but they whitewash everything.
Mm-hmm.
Dave, do you think you could go back to live that younger person lifestyle, like your struggling 20s, now that you've become a successful podcaster?
No. Oh, God, no. I don't want to live in an apartment with like four different people and eat eggs and beans every day. How about you?
Hell no.
Yeah.
That's all I can say.
There's like a baseline. There's like a baseline you need.
With all that podcaster money that we
have.
So
much of it. Oh, I'm sitting on a pile of money.
So much of it. I'm currently throwing dollar bills in the air. Actually, Dave and I have only made negative dollars on this whole endeavor. Just to clarify that.
Yeah, negative dollars.
But we are not struggling by any means because we also have jobs.
Is that a subtle dig for a sponsor?
Yes. If you want to become a Titan level sponsor, send us $1,000 and we will do Titanic just for you. Go to our Patreon page and
if you want to be a sponsor, let us know. We'll put an ad, we'll put a sponsor in the middle for your podcast or whatever weird thing you have. We don't care.
Dave and I will even attempt to write something witty for you.
I hope you take the lead because I'm not funny. That's what people keep saying about the podcast. They're like, you're funny. And I'm like, I'm not funny. None of us are funny. We're just like, this is who we are.
Dave, you're funny looking.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
What is happening now is Zola's ready to retire, basically. He realizes Cézanne is right. He's kind of lost the fire that he once had in him. And he does. This is actually where we get into the movie, finally. So I feel like up until this point, this is about 30, 35 minutes into the movie. It is the life of Emile Zola. And from here on out, it's actually the Dreyfus Affair. And I feel like the movie is much better from this point forward. So we get the plot, which is juicy. We get intrigue, we get mystery, we get all the stuff that you really want.
And it's kind of confusing, too, because it's called The Life of Emile Zola. And you're like, what? Who are these people?
I would say you could probably even skip ahead 30 minutes and not miss out on much of anything. From here on out, I actually really like the movie. We see Count Esterhazy, who is part of the French military, send a letter with military secrets to the Germans. He's actually Austrian himself, for reasons I don't exactly know, joined the French army. The French army's general staff gets a hold of the letter and realizes it's one of their own. So someone on their staff, they're basically like, we can't let people know about this. People have basically caught on to that there's a mole in the group, so they need to blame somebody. They dismiss that it could possibly be the count, who is Austrian by birth, but this royal, and they blame a Jewish officer instead, very specifically because he's Jewish. This is an anti-Semitic campaign. There's a lot of anti-Semitism in Europe at the time, and unfortunately, this officer, whose name was Alfred Dreyfus, is a victim of this. So he gets chosen to be the scapegoat. And the film really only hints at this ever so slightly. They're basically going through the general staff's bios. And in Alfred Dreyfus's bio, it says Jew. They just choose him for that reason specifically. Dreyfus is called in to the office and then arrested in kind of a sting. And it's clearly a cover up for the count. He's taken away. Dreyfus's family is informed on what has happened. And he's quickly found guilty in a sham trial. He's stripped of his military rank and a public shaming.
In the name of the people of France, Alfred Dreyfus, captain of the 14th Regiment of Artillery, having been found guilty of the crime of treason by unanimous vote of the court-martial, is condemned to deportation for life. The court-martial also orders that prior to the sentence being carried out, the said Captain Dreyfus shall be paraded before the garrison of Paris and there publicly degraded and dismissed from the service, according to the code of military law, thus forfeiting his decorations and privileges and the right to bear arms forever.
In the name of the French people, we deprive you of your rank. You are unworthy of wearing the uniform.
I'm innocent. My wife and my children, I swear. I'm innocent. Long live France! I'm innocent. Proclaim to the world that I'm innocent! I'm innocent! I'm innocent! I'm innocent!
Public shaming, they literally tear off his army insignia from his coat and break his sword over their knee, and then they send him off to a prison colony, Devil's Island.
That's the shittiest sword break.
It's like his sword just snaps, and you're like, yeah. I guess, you know, if it's purely decorative. I looked into this, I thought this was kind of interesting. Devil's Island, so what is it? It's off the coast of French Guiana. Dave, do you know where French Guiana is?
It's next to normal Guiana.
Next to Guyana, yeah, that's true. It's in Suriname, which was Dutch Guiana at a certain point. It is in South America, on the northeastern coast of South America. This little island is less than a quarter mile in size, so it's very, very small, and it was used to house political prisoners, about 15 of them. There were three islands in this little area that were used to house France's worst criminals. There's lots of prisoner violence, as well as deadly tropical diseases. To give you a further idea of these conditions, France had tried to colonize French Guiana several times, but over 12,000 died in 1 year in one of these attempts, and they kind of gave up on it. I've actually been to regular Guiana. It's the English version of it. It's right on the equator. It's very hot. It's probably pretty miserable if you don't have any amenities like that. I can see how, you know, it would wreak havoc on you. I was on malaria pills. I don't know how many shots I had to have before I went there. But it's, I don't want to say inhospitable because there are people, there are a lot of people who live there and they're totally fine, but you are battling the elements for sure.
Yeah. You have to be used to it.
Yeah.
Sounds miserable. It's called Devil's Island.
I am sure it is. To make things worse, I saw in one of the notes, sometimes they even kept people on these prison frigates out in the bay. So they weren't even on land, but it was slightly nicer than living on the island, apparently. So while they were on the island, they also have to forage for their own food and create their own jobs. So it was like pretty miserable. Yeah.
It's like, all right, you are the official rock clapper.
Yeah. So during this trial and all that, the army is seeding out all this information. It's fake information to the news agencies. So the media finds Dreyfus guilty, drags his name through the mud. And then in the eye of the public, he's doubly as guilty. So everything that could go wrong basically goes wrong for poor Alfred Dreyfus.
Yeah, he's the real hero of this story.
Yes. Another officer catches the count passing secrets to the Germans. He investigates and then finds that the handwriting from the letter he nabbed was the same as the one that was used to convict Dreyfus. He now knows that that's bogus and the count is clearly guilty. He takes this to the army's general staff and they basically say, nope, that's not true at all. You need to shut your mouth. And then they ship this officer to a remote hardship post, basically so that he can't tell anyone what he's found.
Yeah. Is this the point of the movie where they say, we can't have the people's faith in us be shaken? And they're like, we're right, even if we're wrong.
Right. The count is then tried and found innocent.
Dreyfus's wife is armed with evidence that essentially her husband was railroaded. She goes to Zola to ask him if he can help spread the word about her husband's innocence. Remember that he is a leading intellectual. He is very famous at this point.
And his past papers have been very effective in swaying public opinion. She knows that she'll take up this cause.
I get that he doesn't really want to, but she leaves the evidence with him. And he, being curious, picks it up and starts flipping through it and realizes that Dreyfus was set up. And he decides to put his weight behind the cause.
I mean, I think even more shocking to him is that there's a massive cover-up. The army is conspiring against Dreyfus, like, so clearly. And that's why he's pissed off. Because he assumed that Dreyfus was guilty just like everybody else until he started looking at the evidence.
So we should also, like, note, this is his character arc. He's like, oh, I have to put my reputation on the line to save this man because it's right. And I should just do the right thing because it is the right thing.
Exactly, exactly.
Zola decides to get behind it. And he writes an over 4,000 word essay that is published on the front page of a newspaper called, it's in English, it's I Accuse.
J'accuse.
J'accuse.
Mr. President, I accuse Colonel Dawe of having been the diabolical agent of the affair and of continuing to defend his deadly work through 3 years of revolting machinations. I accuse the Minister of War of having concealed decisive proofs of the innocence of Dreyfus. I accuse the Chief of Staff and the Assistant Chief of Staff of being accomplices in the same crime. I accuse the commander of the Paris garrison of the most monstrous partiality. I accuse the War Office of having viciously led a campaign to misdirect public opinion and cover up its sins. I accuse the first court-martial of violating all human rights and condemning a prisoner on testimony kept secret from him. And finally, I accuse the Esterhazy court-martial of covering up this illegality by order, thus in turn committing the judicial crime of acquitting a guilty man. In making these accusations, I am aware that I render myself open to prosecution for libel. But that does not matter. The action I take is designed only to hasten the explosion of truth and justice. Let there be a trial in the full light of day. I am waiting.
He becomes a marked man because of it. When I was doing my research, John, I found that he actually had a whole plan around this. His entire purpose of writing this article was to get sued by the government for libel, and so they would have to talk about the Dreyfus case.
We see that happen.
We absolutely see that happen.
What else do we see going on in the background there?
The government doesn't like this, so they hire thugs to essentially besmirch his name, to burn his books, to rile up the public.
And they just like outright riot.
Yeah. I know we mentioned earlier, but riots did happen throughout this time period in France. So, John, what are some examples of this happening today? Examples of large organizations, government or not, manipulating public opinion for their good.
Or just covering it up. Right now, I just think of these impeachment trials and how every single one of Donald Trump's top advisors, almost every single one, has ended up guilty of criminal charges and gone to jail. I think the same thing is with this thing that we're seeing in the news about the Ukraine as well. So he's asking for this quid pro quo about, I will give your country funding for things if you investigate one of my political rivals, which is highly illegal. Saying he's done it and then trying to deny that it's happened, or everyone's trying to deny this happened, even though he's publicly admitted that he's done these things. There's like this shifting narrative. The Republicans are constantly trying to change. Donald Trump is shooting them all in the foot, or shooting them in the back, whatever you want to say, when this happens. I mean, it's insanity. It's crazy. I see that happening a lot right now. We see more examples like this coming up in the movie in a few. What about you, Dave? What do you have?
So I have some specific examples that I think you can cite here. There is the RNC spending $100,000 to buy Donald Trump Jr.'s latest book in order to manipulate the bestseller list to show that he is, quote unquote, a bestseller and that his opinion should be taken more seriously. That's a clear manipulation of public trust. I should also say that that happens fairly frequently, predominantly in politics. It's the right doing it more than the left, but it happens other ways too. L. Ron Hubbard, he famously had all his followers buy his crazy long book, Battlefield Earth. So it became one of the New York Times bestsellers.
And then became a movie.
It's one of Neil Gaiman's favorite books. It is Mitt Romney's favorite book.
I heard it was really bad. I've never read it.
I own it. I bought it for $1 on Kindle. I was like, fuck it, I'll try it. It's just super long. And there's also, like, something you've talked about, John, is the widespread parroting of a defunct Ukrainian theory. Don't know how to say this in a pleasant way. It's not real. It didn't happen. The idea that Ukraine meddled in the election is being propagated by the Russians. Like, today I heard a senator say, there's more than one way to interpret facts. When all the intelligence committees say, no, this happened, you're just wrong, right? Like, kind of blows my mind.
So I think we're seeing a lot of people just ignoring facts for their own narrative. And that's kind of what's happening here as well, although in a different capacity.
There are examples of left-leaning people doing this as well. And like All the President's Men, the movie we covered with the Democratic governor. Yeah, so there are examples of this happening on both sides. Currently, it's being predominantly broadcast by the right-leaning segments of American politics.
You've got crazy theories about gunmen who don't exist, white slavery rings in pizza shops. We don't even have to get into all this. It's pretty frequent, pretty common.
Yep.
That Sandy Hook was a fake shooting.
Yeah.
I don't even know what the other ones are. I'm not ensconced in that craziness.
We haven't talked anything about like a specific journalist being targeted by the government. And the closest would be like Julian Assange, but I don't consider him a journalist. Maybe, what's his name? The guy, Snowden.
I mean, I even feel Snowden's unfairly targeted. He is a whistleblower who's gotten screwed. That's kind of my opinion, but maybe people don't agree with me because pretty much everything he said has been accurate and true.
Crazy.
He's like Emile Zola, right? He's like, well, we'll get to that in a little bit. Okay. So Zola is brought to court for committing libel against the government. So they're saying the article he published is slanderous, not true, and causing problems. In this court trial, the court limits what can be argued. They keep saying the Dreyfus case is closed and can't be argued. All the army members called to testify refuse, saying they've been ordered not to report to court. Dave, does this sound like anything we've seen recently?
Oh, yeah. Let's dive into this some more. Yes. Let's just be really clear here. During the impeachment inquiry that is happening at the moment, the White House is refusing to let key witnesses testify. I mean, it's pretty the same thing, right?
Yes, they just say we're not coming, even though they've been subpoenaed.
Yeah, it's sort of ridiculous. And it's more ridiculous because they're like, well, you can't prove this happened. It's like, well, there's a lot of body of evidence that indicates that it more than likely did. And the people that you won't let testify can corroborate that. And so what I would say is like, you don't get to complain unless you are under subpoena, you've been sworn in, and you risk the chance of going to jail.
A lot of the people we see testifying right now are government people who were appointed by someone in the Trump office. Mike Pence's aide on Ukrainian affairs. I think even former secretary of, which one, state?
Yeah.
Bolton, right? He's like going crazy against Trump at this point, too. There was even a weird story in the news the other day that he's like, Trump locked my Twitter account down so I couldn't use it. And it took me 30 days to free it back up so I could tweet what I want. Trump's like, I don't know how to do that. I'm like, yeah, Trump, we know you don't know how to do that. But did you ask someone on your staff to do that?
Right, but that's such like the logic. He's like, I personally didn't do it.
That one is a weird story to me. It was reported in the Washington Post. And some of you are going to be like, the Washington Post.
I mean, at this point, John, we've lost all our conservative listeners.
I think they do their work, right? Like they're you know, checking their sources and stuff. So that is a weird story. I don't know what the outcome's going to be on that one. That could be bogus. I'll give it that. But the other ones, you're just like, yep, he actually said that and he actually did that. And then everyone testified that he did it.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Stressful year. Okay.
I don't even know if it's good if he does get impeached.
Is it good? No.
It'll just further divide the country. I honestly am not even sure what's going to happen if he gets defeated in an election. Will he just say it's rigged again? And then we'll have literal street fights, shootouts in the street over who, you know, takes over next. Like, will it be a peaceful handover of the seat of the president?
I don't know. Let's get back to this movie. We are going way abreast, way afield.
Okay. So the officer who caught Esterhazy originally, the guy that was put to the hardship post, is called back to France to testify. He says he knew that Esterhazy was guilty for years, and then the army accuses him of lying, and the judge prevents the line of questioning from proceeding because, again, he says the Dreyfus case is closed and can't be talked about here. The president, I think of France, halts the discussions of anything about the French military, saying it could harm the reputation of the army and have implications for the public. So they're like, can't discuss it. The French military then says they found a secret document finding Dreyfus guilty, and they have it, but it can't be revealed for the safety and security of the nation. The army staff cabal swears that each other is telling the truth. Another officer then comes forward saying this document can't be produced because it is a lie. Zola's lawyer accuses the court of being on the side of the military, and it's clear the courts are going to find Zola guilty anyway.
Tremendous pressure has been put upon you. Save the army. Convict Zola and save France. I say to you, pick up that challenge. Save the army and save France. But do it by letting truth conquer. Not only is an innocent man crying out for justice, but more, much more, a great nation is in desperate danger of forfeiting her honor. Do not take upon yourselves a fault, the burden of which you will forever bear in history. A judicial blunder has been committed. The condemnation of an innocent man induced the acquittal of a guilty man. And now, today, you're asked to condemn me because I rebelled on seeing our country embarked on this terrible course. At this solemn moment, in the presence of this tribunal, which is the representative of human justice, before you gentlemen of the jury, before France, before the whole world, I swear that Dreyfus is innocent. By my 40 years of work, by all that I have won, by all that I have written, to spread the spirit of France, I swear that Dreyfus is innocent. May all that melt away. May my name perish if Dreyfus be not innocent. He is innocent.
We then see the jury, under coercion, finds Zola guilty and sentences him to jail for a year.
The part of this film that blew my mind the most was this part, where basically, like, we have a secret document that you can't see that proves our point. That is Looney Tunes, John.
So it is a huge conspiracy, as we see here, with a massive cover-up, with several branches of the government working together, colluding to prevent the truth from coming out. It's freaking nuts. But it very clearly happened, and maybe it wasn't as evident at the time, because public's opinion was way against Dreyfus. Remember, yeah, we saw he was nailed to the wall by the press. Zola was threatened at all sorts of points. Basically, the French government was even hiring people to stir the public up to fight against Zola and what he was saying, too. So this was like a massive government conspiracy. So Zola, realizing his health is failing, knowing that he could be killed while in jail, deliberates his options before ultimately deciding to flee to England. From there, he continues to write papers.
Yeah. Do you think he made the right move?
I think so. So some of the debate was interesting. Like, they talked about, what will people say if he flees? He was the one who wanted this trial. Clearly, it didn't go well. It does seem like a sham. They basically were not allowed to talk about anything because the government shut down any conversations that would help prove any of his points. I think he ultimately decides to do this because he thinks it's better for him to kind of put his tail between his legs, run off to England, and continue to pressure the government in different ways and write these papers. Ultimately, I think the answer is yes. I'm sure it was a very hard decision. But I think the other half is they could have killed him in jail. It could have just happened where they're just like, oh yeah,
yeah,
he was Epstein'd.
Yeah. I think he made the right decision too. But it had to have been very difficult. I think something that hasn't come through when we're talking about this is that Zola loved Paris, loved France. He was a patriot. He loved it. He loved it. He loved it. So leaving the place that he loved, I'm sure, was very, very difficult.
So several years later, a new war minister is installed in France, and he gets to the bottom of this Dreyfus affair. We then see Esterhazy flee to England. In real life, what happened was there was another trial. Dreyfus was tried again, found guilty again, and then he was ultimately pardoned and released. So they basically said, time served, you're done, we're going to let you go, even though they found him guilty again. And it was another 5 years after that that he was then ultimately pardoned for everything that happened and then reinstated into the army. this was a gigantic affair. It took a while for France to be comfortable with admitting their mistake. You know, Zola continued to live in England at this time. At some point, Zola was also forgiven for his sins, basically, and declared innocent, but he died before he ever came back to France. And that is the end.
It ends basically with the good guys winning. That's what you need to know. The bad guys, all the army officers get dismissed.
Imprisoned, and several even commit suicide.
From what I'm reading, what I understood was that the war minister, when he started to look into this, he thought that Dreyfus was guilty. And the more he looked into it, he found out that he wasn't. And that's sort of what happened. He had like set out to confirm that Dreyfus was actually guilty. I want to touch on something real quickly. Zola died of carbon monoxide poisoning in England. Some people believe that he was killed. He was an assassination. There's debate over that. But he died, I think, at 63. Relatively young, honestly. So I just thought that was interesting. They didn't really touch on that in the movie, but there's controversy around his death.
I did not know that. They did not really touch on that in the movie at all. Dave, themes for this movie. Obviously, this fight for justice we've talked about. What we see Zola doing is questioning authority. So if something doesn't add up...
I would say that those are the two main themes, honestly. There's not a ton here. It's follow your heart, do the right thing, no matter what, which we talked about, and then questioning authority, because just because they're in an authoritative position does not mean they're correct.
So how do you do that, Dave? How do you question authority?
Well, one, get receipts, have proof. It's not enough for someone to tell you that they are correct. They need to prove it and show you they're correct for a specific reason.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the hardest part. There are some situations where you don't want to be like questioning a cop who's telling you put your hands up. You should probably just do that. The idea is like they have to prove they're in the right. And that's hard. That's hard. And they won't do it. They might not do it. And one of the things that I think maybe we should talk about, John. So I've been thinking a lot about when people get into arguments, they complain that both sides should be civil to each other. And I think there is a time and place for civility, but you don't always need to be civil, because if someone's stepping on your throat, you have a right to be angry and fight back any way you can. Because I feel like civility can be weaponized by oppressors. It's like, you aren't being civil to me, so I'm not going to listen to your argument. But that doesn't mean your argument isn't valid.
So I think that's what you saw with both Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. They were saying, we have to be better. We can't react emotionally. All the people that are doubting us and saying that we're uncivil and all these things, if we act that way, we will then prove the point to them. I don't think I said that very well.
Yeah, but I understand what you're saying. This is like two different sides of a concept. It's like, you can't get anything accomplished until you disrupt the system. And then the other side is, you have to be above the system and play by their rules so they will listen to you instead of dismissing you.
Yes. Yeah, that's the unfortunate side of it, is you have to play by those rules, even if they're unfair.
Yeah.
And then you have to be better. So you have to be better than those people.
It's hard. You know, this is something I'm trying to learn about. I'm sure I'm messing up all along the way, but, you know, you have to start somewhere.
I've been reading March, the comic,
mm-hmm.
and if you're familiar with that. So it's about John Lewis. Hold on, I'm just picking it up. I have it sitting over here. And the civil rights movement. So marches in Washington going south for freedom rider events, things like that. If you have an interest in how some people try to accomplish that, this is one of the books that you can read about it. Actually, you know who's quoted on the back?
Who?
LeVar Burton. He's our Reading Rainbow guy.
That's right.
But anyway, I actually really like this graphic novel. So there are three parts to it. I am on part two right now. Worth checking out.
Anyway, if you have some tips on how to speak truth to power, you let us know and we'll share it with the audience.
Fight the system.
If you can word things better than we have, we'll gladly listen and respond.
So, Dave, why do you think this movie won?
I think that's a really good question to ask, even though we ask it every episode. In general, I think this is a relatively well-done movie with decent acting, a decent plot. It's just sort of well done all around. I also think that the United States of America has sort of a special relationship to France. It would probably resonate more with our society than stories from other countries.
It's about fighting tyranny and looking for justice. I think Americans like to pride themselves on that because our Revolutionary War was basically fought for those reasons. I get your point there. I totally agree. So I definitely see that. I think there are some parallels with what was happening in Nazi Germany in 1937. So with governments, again, not always being for all their people and blaming certain people. It's also a really touching story of bravery, justice, and tenacity. I think that plays into the American ideals, fighting that system, sticking up for what's right. I also felt like this movie, while I thought the beginning was kind of slow, did not lull very much after that. It's an exciting courtroom drama. You definitely feel the tension and you're upset by the outcome.
Yeah, I agree. It moved way faster than I thought it was. Sometimes when we do these older movies, I want to pull my hair out.
So, critique, Dave. What would you change about this film?
So I don't have a ton to critique. I think I would probably drop the first part to get to the Dreyfus Affair faster and spend more time on the Dreyfus Affair.
I agree. I think I would condense some of that. I think they cut out some of the more important points about the anti-Semitism and some of the other pieces that they didn't talk enough about, you know, in the life of Zola himself. I think we could have gotten to a little more depth on his character because he just comes across as some saint. And clearly, as what we've heard from Dave, he wasn't. So I think it would have been good to kind of touch on some of those other pieces as well.
Yeah.
Did you have a favorite part?
I think my favorite part was about the book, Nana. Like, I thought that was really funny. We already covered it a little bit. But he also did a really good job giving the speech when he told everyone that he was going to publish I Accuse. I thought that was very well done.
Muni as an actor did a really good job physically as well. So older Zola moves a little slow, hunches over. Younger Zola is a little more spry. Winner or wiener, Dave?
So it's a winner.
I agree.
Yeah. So I'm going to say that this is actually a solid B to B plus. This isn't my favorite one of the movies we've watched on our journey so far, but it's good. I would recommend it. I'm probably not going to watch it again for another 20 years, honestly. The question I have for you, John, is why do you think it's sort of fallen off the radar? Because I can't find anything about it. No one talks about it. It's just sort of this anomaly.
I don't know. I'd really not heard much about this movie either. The courtroom scenes are really good. I don't know when courtroom dramas became a thing, but you could maybe say this is an early courtroom drama film. I don't know if that's true, but it's definitely one of the better ones.
Yeah, I would say so too. I wish I knew a little bit more about French courtrooms because I was trying to keep up because they had to speak to the judge they gave. It was confusing at points.
Right. I don't watch a lot of courtroom movies. So Dave, do you have any movies that you felt were similar that you could recommend if people like this movie? What else should they check out?
So just courtroom dramas?
I mean, for me, that's what I think of. Is there another movie you feel, if you like this movie, what else should you check out?
Aaron Brockovich. A lighter one is My Cousin Vinny. They're like barely touching. John Grisham's De Jure.
Mm-hmm. Porn parody. Dave, you got a name?
Courting the Court. Not my best. How about you?
Calling it Devil's Island, Dreyfus's Affair. So it's about the affair Dreyfus had on Devil's Island with his roommate. It's a prison romance with a tropical setting.
Ah.
Twist at the end. It's just a coconut.
I've got a lovely bunch of coconuts. <Do-do-do-do-do>.
All right.
Bonus features. How are the bonus features?
Were there any bonus features on the DVD?
There were. They're nothing to do with the movie. They are little snippets of other things that played with the original film.
Dave, any feedback for us?
Yes. So our friends from the Movie Seller podcast sent us a package. And I'm going to open it on air. So, to give you just some idea, it's in a brown paper bag or brown bag. It feels...
The package came in the mail in a brown paper bag?
Yeah, I know. Not like a real... It's a package. It's brown packaging, okay? I don't know what it is, but let's open it up. Here it comes. Wow, 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 wow. Oh, shit. It's a VHS of Kingdom of Spiders starring William Shatner. Bow, bow, bow. Okay, so one, guys, thank you so much for sending us. This thing is fucking amazing. I'm going to read the back of it for you. nominated as Best Horror Film of 1997 by the Academy of Sci-Fi, Fantasy, and Horror Films, Kingdom of the Spiders features William Shatner as a concerned veterinarian faced with the puzzling death of a number of local farm animals. As even greater numbers of the helpless animals meet their deaths, it is discovered that hundreds of tarantulas occupy the farmland. This is strange indeed. Tarantulas don't live in colonies. Or do they? John, have you ever heard of this movie?
Nope.
Neither have I, but I can tell you right now, I'm stoked. This ties into another movie I did a while back for Movie Films and Flicks. I covered Eight-Legged Freaks. I guess I'm going to be on a spider kick.
But they have eight legs. Lots of kicking.
That they have eight legs. Do you think this is worth a weekend watch?
So how are you going to watch it?
I don't have a VHS. My parents have a VHS. I'd have to go to Cincinnati, hook up their VHS, hope it still works, and then watch it.
I think we might be able to find a more technological solution, but you'll be there anyway, right? You're going home for Christmas, maybe?
Yeah, I'll definitely be there. I mean, I could also just rent it, you know, on Amazon, if it exists on Amazon, which I'm sure it exists on something. A movie that was nominated for the Best Picture in 1977 isn't going to just disappear, right?
Right. So, Dave, who's in this movie again?
William Shatner.
And how does that tie into what you and I are doing next?
That's a great question. So we are part of a... Yes, we are part of an advent calendar of movie podcasts, and we are going to record a bonus episode of A Christmas Horror Story, which stars our man, William Shatner.
Boom.
Have you seen A Christmas Horror Story?
No. Actually, I may have caught in a few minutes of it here or there, but it looks pretty ridiculous.
It's a set of interwoven stories, so it's four stories, and the wraparound is William Shatner as a drunk DJ. I have not seen it either, so I don't really know what it's about, but I'm pretty stoked. We will let everyone know when that episode airs. It'll be in December. Check out our Instagram to know more. And then if you're interested in what we're going to do next in our Oscars journey, our big giant Oscars journey, do you want to tell them what it is, John?
It's a two-parter.
Titanic 1 and 2?
Yes.
VHS 1 and VHS 2?
So no, not that. Godfather 1 and 2.
That's awesome. Have you seen those movies?
I have.
I have, and I don't remember them.
They're very, very long.
They're very, very long.
We will try to condense everything into a short episode, which is unlikely to happen, but we'll try.
And we're definitely going to make a hot dog paste to put in a cannoli, right?
No, I'm going to chop up a hot dog and you're going to wake up next to it.
With ketchup all over it?
Yeah. Just screaming, hot dog! No!
All right. So John, this has been a lot of fun. And everyone out there, if you want to contact us, if you have something to say, please feel free to email us at david@awardwieners.com or john@awardwieners.com. We also have a very active Instagram page. We do movie quotes. We talk about movie reviews. And then most weeks we do a weekend watch. So what happens is that on Fridays, at some point, I will put up a movie that one of us are going to watch over the weekend. And then we do a review of it on Monday.
Sometimes I try to watch one of the movies that you suggest and stop 10 minutes in.
Sometimes I make bad decisions, but I power through.
Banana Split?
The Banana Splits movie, not a good movie. Incredibly boring.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a bunch of crap.
Yeah.
And that's a banana joke.
Yeah, but there's also some good ones out there. I did Chopping Mall, and let me tell you, Chopping Mall is amazing.
Yes, I have seen that one as well. Okay. Anything else to tell our dear listeners, Dave?
No, that's it.
All right. Stay out of trouble.
break it, break it, break it down.